Let's talk. Talk.
John Brown. Cold War test pilots surviving crash landings and emergency ejections from fast jets to heavy multi-engine aircraft. This is the story of Group Captain Ron Burrows. I'm delighted to say that Ron joins us live on the line now. Ron, good morning to you.
Good morning, Charles.
Thanks for joining us. We have this image of perhaps a modern jet pilot being, especially in the Royal Air Force, being something of a consummate professional using the very latest in technology. But it takes a certain sort of individual who gets in sort of for the first time to push an aircraft to its limits before it can be, if you like, unleashed on the rest of the Royal Air Force. How did you start in the RAF?
Well, I went through the normal training as a pilot in the RAF. I started in 1962, and you go through about a year's worth of basic training on the Jet Provost in my case, then on the Vampire for another 6 months, and then on the Hunter, and then I became operational out in Southern Arabia at the time in Aden. I did a tour on as a flying instructor at Oxford University Air Squadron, and then back at the Central Flying School. And then I applied to become I applied for test pilot training, and I got selected happily to the US Navy Test Pilot School in Maryland. So that's how I started as a test pilot.
It must have been a fascinating time to be flying jets, because we are in the early 60s, so we're really only sort of, 15, 16 years after sort of the first real jet engines come into use, just after, you know, that period between, say, 45 to 50. And you've got things like the Lightning, the Buccaneer. I mean, there was a very well-known gentleman who ran a bar, RAF type, red trousers all the time, called Reginald, and he said that Vampires were the best things he'd ever flown.
The Vampire was quite a good aeroplane at the time. Remember, the Vampire only narrowly missed becoming operational in the Second World War. It was just pipped at the post by the Meteor.
Mm.
And from that point, which was still a fairly basic jet aeroplane, radial centrifugal compressor, very low, very slow pickup time. From that point, in the next 20 years, we were up to the Lightning and the Phantom and the Buccaneer and so on. You know, we made tremendous progress in the 20 years after the war. By the time I joined in 62, we were already thinking about the follow-on to the V-bombers. And you remember the TSR-2 story. So that's when I came into the test flying business in 1970.
It must be a fast. I mean, there's new technology coming on, but it isn't. I know it's been going though for a period of time, but it's still, if you look at the way that aircraft function 50 years ago, 60 years ago, as opposed to sort of today, then all sorts of things could go wrong with sort of not only fighter aircraft, but also sort of larger aircraft. And it must have been, you must have, as we call it in Spain, you must have had cojones of steel to be a test pilot. What was the thing that drove you to become a test pilot when you know that, you know, if things can go wrong, they sort of do very, very quickly. And in the case of jets, presumably, normally quite catastrophically.
Yes, they can go wrong, and as technology has improved, they go wrong less often, but they still do go wrong. Flying fast jets, you always had the very nice comfort of being sitting on an ejection seat. So if things go terribly, terribly wrong, you can always pull a handle and get out. And I had to do that, as you probably have read in my book, twice. Which is a much happier ending than going down with your aircraft.
To put it mildly. But when you're testing something that doesn't have an ejector seat, if you're doing, you know, a larger an aircraft, and presumably it's you know, there's an awful lot. I mean, do you build margins of error in thinking, okay, if I have a hydraulic failure with landing gear, or if something happens with, you know, if you've got a multi-engine aircraft, if something happens with engine number one, I know I can bring it in on engine 2, 3, 4, whatever.
Yes, in larger aircraft, you generally have a bit more redundancy. As you say, if one engine goes, you can generally continue on the remaining engine or remaining engines. But remember, too, that when you're flying, you practice emergencies. You spend a lot of time in simulators, and if you haven't got a simulator, you spend a lot of time thinking about what would I do if this went wrong or that went wrong. So you're generally not caught short. You know, you've always got some backup plan in your mind.
What were the differences then between being in the UK and being a test pilot for the RAF and going over stateside, and presumably weather is a big thing about this, because you know you can go, if you're testing an aircraft in the States, normally it's in a long bit of desert, normally the weather's quite good, as opposed to the fact that, you know, as opposed to maybe somewhere in the Scottish Highlands where it's always drizzly and there's the possibility of sticking into the side of a mountain or a ravine.
Well, when I trained in the States, I trained in Maryland with the US Navy, and they're not very different to the Air Force, to the Royal Air Force, in terms of their operating approach. In testing aircraft, you generally pick good weather. You know, generally also you've got good radar to help you. You've got a radar controller who would probably be dedicated to keeping you clear of other aircraft and giving you free airspace in which to carry out your tests and help you with deconfliction from other aircraft. So it's not as risky as you might think. We take precautions. We rehearse our flight test profiles in a similar way to the way an athlete might imagine his jump or his run or whatever. You know, you're not going into it without any kind of preparation. I mean, with the Phantom, for example, I'd never flown it before. It was quite a leap in terms of performance. There were no simulators. There were no two stickers available at the time. So I spent quite a lot of time in the hangar, sitting in the aeroplane, rehearsing what I was going to do, you know, looking at the instruments I was going to be looking at, operating the switches and so on. So it's quite a lot of mental preparation before you get airborne.
Well, one of the things that I like about it is the fact that's, I mean, I know it may sound a little strange, but that sort of 70s Cold War era, and you have things like the Tornado and the Jaguars coming on board, and they really were quite something, were they, as aircraft, and they must have been exhilarating, slightly daunting to sit behind and flip the on switch.
I almost grew up with the Tornado. It was called the MRCA when I first joined the program in 1971. And I was involved with my fellow test pilots from Germany and Italy in the cockpit design and the systems design and the workload balance between front and back cockpit. So when it came to the point when I first got into it to fly it, I was already quite familiar with the aeroplane. But the Tornado was really cutting edge at the time. In the early 1970s, it was fly-by-wire. It had terrain-following radar and autopilot. It had head-up display and projective map displays, all of the bells and whistles. And it was a very capable aeroplane. It could do more than twice the speed of sound. As you probably remember, it had variable wing sweep, for example. So it was an exhilarating aeroplane to fly and a very capable aeroplane to fly.
Come 1982, and the task force is steaming towards the Falklands, and I hadn't really thought about this, but this was an environment that it was going into that it hadn't really been expected to go into the South Atlantic. This is the Harrier, of course, and you were involved in basically seeing, was it, I mean, I suppose in modern parts we call it upgrades, wouldn't we? I suppose, and new sort of bits bolted on to make it more sustainable and more effective in the environment it was going into.
Yes, in both versions of the Harrier, the Sea Harrier and the GR version, which was the RAF Harrier, they had to put one or two extra things onto the aircraft, including the Sidewinder missile, of course. But the Air Force version of the Harrier hadn't been cleared for taking off on this ski jump. You remember the ramps on the front of the Invincible class carriers. The GR version had not been cleared for that, and so we had to do some pretty quick testing on the GR version before we could clear it for use in the South Atlantic. With a ski jump like that, if you hit the ramp too fast, you can actually damage the undercarriage. If you hit the ramp too slow, you'll go off the end without flying speed and get run over by the ship that's sort of coming
sorry.
Far
yes.
behind you.
I'd say, yes, indeed.
We had to do a lot of testing on the GR version on the ski jump, and as the fleet was steaming southwards, we were doing all these various tests, and in those days, of course, we had no emails or anything like that. We were telexing our clearances and our recommendations to the fleet as it steamed south. Yeah, quite an interesting period. And also, we had to do a lot of in-flight refueling testing too.
Sure.
Behind various aeroplanes. Because we needed all the in-flight refueling assets we could get to reach the South Atlantic.
I know this might sound facile, but presumably, I mean, you were always pushing to a final aim, but when you have a situation like you had in 82, and you know that there are people whose lives depend on this, and they are sailing south, presumably it focused you and the rest of the team, you know, 110%.
Yes, I mean, it was an all-out effort. It was probably similar to World War II days where you know, you basically had to get the job done quickly. And so everybody in the Ministry of Defence in all three services were engaged in the Ministries of Defence as well as the establishments like Boscombe Down.
What's the Harrier like to fly, by the way? Because I mean, you know, the Americans, didn't they had a version of the Envy for the US Marines. But I mean, presumably it's quite an interesting concept and must have been quite challenging or quite different to fly.
It was a very capable aeroplane, fun to fly. The early version of the Harrier, the GR version of the Harrier, the first Royal Air Force version of it before the second generation came along, was quite tricky in the regime between zero airspeed and wing-borne flight, which was at about 120 knots, 130 knots. In that regime, between zero airspeed and about 100, 120 knots, the aircraft was actually unstable directionally, and it had very little reaction control authority for you to correct it. So if you picked up too much side slip, for example, you could run out of roll control and find yourself rolling uncontrollably. And you had a very, very little time to get out if you were going to get out. That happened quite a few times early on. Mm. The second generation of Harrier, the AV-8B, and it's the version now that the Americans are still flying in the States, was more, it had more authority in the reaction controls. It wasn't quite as critical from a handling point of view, and it had some automatic stability augmentation. So the whole thing became an easier aeroplane to fly.
Was there ever an aeroplane that you looked at and you thought, you know, I'd really rather not get in that one again? I mean, something like, I don't know, the Tempest, which is from the Second World War. But was an airplane you thought, you know, I'll give this a crack, and then thought, you know, I'm going to have to speak to whoever designed this one, because there are certain things that I might want refining, he said.
The one airborne vehicle that I had that feeling about was a flex wing microlight.
Right.
You know, a weight shift microlight. You know, in a conventional aeroplane, everything is instinctive. If you move the stick to the left, you will roll to the left. To the right, you will roll to the right. If you push the stick forward, the nose will go down and vice versa. In a flex wing weight shift microlight, it's exactly the other way around. If you want to go to the left, you move the bar to the right. And if you want to go down, instead of pushing the stick forward, you bring the bar back. And it takes a little bit of time to get used to that. So I describe my flying in that vehicle as a unique opportunity in that I will never want to repeat it.
Marvellous. Is there a particular sort of sense of humour then? I mean, an understatement between, you know, yourselves, the control, you know, the air traffic controllers of the control tower when you're doing something like that. Is there, are you all sort of masters of understatement when it comes to doing this? And I think that's a particular RAF trait, because if you listen to some of the, for example, listen to some of the transcripts that come from Bomber Command during the Second World War, it's all very sort of 30 seconds to bolt in the whole bit. And then you hear, listen to the USAAF, and it's a bit more animated. I mean, were there sort of some master of understatements that came out whilst you were testing?
Well, it's the classic British stiff upper lip, isn't it? You know, we'd and also we get used to it, don't we? You don't make a big deal of it. I suppose that's probably part of the selection process. You know, you're selected to be relatively calm and level-headed and not given to too much excitement. Yeah. Anyway, remember, we were also very young people. Young men somehow feel themselves invincible, and therefore you don't think about the risks that you're taking quite so much. And as I say, there's always a way out if you've prepared carefully.
What was perhaps one of the highlights? I mean, is there no better feeling than taking a fast jet out for half an hour or a morning when the sort of dawn's breaking over, I don't know, Southern Arabia or whatever?
Yeah, there are some beautiful moments when you're up early in the morning, as you say, and the sun's coming up or the sun's going down, and you get these beautiful colours of reflections on the clouds and the distant horizon. There are lots of very special moments which I remember very well.
What do you think? What are you hoping the people will take from the book?
Well, first of all, it is a book about flight testing in the Cold War period. Mm. So already it's history. In my day, there were a lot of aeroplanes. When I joined the Air Force, we had 150,000 people in it. We've now got about 32,000. We had bases around the world. We had aircraft of all types, and it was a very exciting place to be. These days, of course, there are fewer aeroplanes and fewer people. Because we had a lot of aircraft, there was a lot of flight testing to do. You mentioned earlier the Buccaneer and the Harrier and the Tornado and so on. Every few years, we were getting a new prototype, a new aircraft to test. So as a test pilot, it was a very interesting era. I think it is different now. Boscombe Down, where I spent 4 flight test tours, was a very busy place, very interesting place, full of specialists. When I joined it, there were 4,000 people working at Boscombe Down. Very few are working there now. Mm. Mostly civil servant, scientists, technicians, engineers, a couple of hundred military aircrew like myself contributing to this whole thing. So, yes, it is a very different era. And the book, I think, well, hopes to explain some of the flight testing that we did on a range of aeroplanes, many of which we've just spoken about. It should be good reading. And it is actually selling quite well.
Well, I should imagine it would do, because I mean, everybody from my generation at least had one model Tornado. I'm going to run out of time, unfortunately, Ron, because I could have talked to you for at least the next 24 hours. The book is called Cold War Test Pilot. It's by Group Captain Ron Burrows, who's been speaking today. Ron, thank you so much for your time today.
It's been a pleasure.